We're doing Tanya 200, celebrating the 200th year since the first publication of the Tanya. In the Tanya, the Rebbe is describing the qualities, the powers, the functions, and the garments of the godly soul. The intelligence of the godly soul understands the greatness of God. That gives birth to the emotions that are godly, the love of God and the fear of God. And then there are the garments of the soul through which the soul's love and fear can be clothed in godliness, in the godliness of the Torah, through the doing of the mitzvahs, the studying of the Torah, and the thinking of the godly thoughts. And that's why Torah is compared to water. Just as water comes down, the Torah comes down. Godliness is made available in the Torah so that when the soul engages the Torah, either through thought or through speech or through action, the soul then acquires the oneness, being clothed and enveloped in the godliness of the mitzvah, and thereby becomes one with God. Now, although the mitzvah is clothed in physical activity, you eat the matzah on Pesach, you blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, you put the tefillin made out of leather on your head and arm, you give the dollar bill to charity, to tzedakah, the godliness within the mitzvah is not obstructed by the garment, by the physical substance with which the mitzvah is performed. The Rebbe used an interesting analogy. If you embrace the king, if you hug the king, is it any less significant, is the hug any less meaningful if the king happens to be wearing two coats rather than one coat? Is the embrace less significant if your arm with which you're embracing the king is clothed in two sleeves rather than one sleeve or no sleeve? Obviously not. The garment does not interfere in the meaningfulness or the significance of the embrace, because the garment being worn disappears. It dissolves into the person wearing it. If you hug a garment, that's a little strange. But if you're hugging a person wearing his garments, the garment doesn't interfere at all. So when the soul embraces the mitzvah, the godliness in the mitzvah, that embrace is an embrace of godliness. It's not that you're eating matzah, you're eating the mitzvah, the godliness in it. It's not that you're wearing leather boxes, you're wearing godliness. Just to use a simple example, if you go into a souvenir shop and you see this little trinket made out of 5 cents worth of wood or 10 cents worth of shells, and you look at the price, $29, $39, $49, and you wonder, why does 10 cents worth of wood cost $49? And of course the answer is, this is not a little piece of wood. It's a work of art. It's an object d'art. And the same is true with a mitzvah. When you eat matzah on Pesach, you're not consuming crackers. When you give a dollar bill to charity, it's not just a dollar's worth of mitzvah. It becomes an object of godliness. So the little piece of wood disappears and is replaced by an object of art. The piece of matzah disappears and is transformed into a piece of godliness. So when the soul does the mitzvah, it is embracing the godliness, not the physical object, which has dissolved and has been transformed into godliness. Now, when it comes to the garment of thought, this oneness, this closeness, this merging of two into one is even more profound and deeper than the other mitzvahs. So that, for example, the study of Torah, which is primarily the garment of thought, although you speak the words as well, but it's the garment of thought with which you study the Torah. Here, we have a unique and awesome merging of two into one. In the physical world, whenever you have two objects and you reduce them down to one, it's done by having the larger object absorb the smaller object. You can put a smaller sphere into a larger sphere. You can put the small pot into a big pot. Or the children's toys, you can put the little block into the larger block. But that's not really two becoming one, because it's a unidirectional oneness. The larger is absorbing the smaller, but the smaller is not absorbing the larger. It's physically impossible. But in the spiritual, particularly in the garment of thought, in the world of intellect, when a person studies a subject, there is a merging that is bidirectional, or two directions. The mind absorbs the idea, and the idea absorbs the mind. When a person is engaged in studying, his mind, his intelligence, is submerged in the subject. You're lost in thought. You are enveloped by the idea. So the idea surrounds the mind, so to speak, and the mind is submerged in the thought. But as you grasp the idea, now all of a sudden, your mind is surrounding, encompassing the idea, and the idea is now submerged or contained within your mind. So there's a double merging, a mutual merging of mind and concept, where they become inseparable, where you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. So when a person studies Torah, he's studying a commandment, or he's studying a statement in the Talmud. He's trying to understand the reason. He's trying to understand the lesson. His mind is immersed in the idea. The idea surrounds him, envelops him. As he begins to understand it, he starts to envelop the idea. His mind now grasps, which means surrounds the idea from all directions. He can see where the concept begins and where it ends, which is really the definition of grasping an idea. And now his mind and the Torah have become one and the same, merged into each other, not only one into the other. However, with Torah, there is one major distinction that makes it different from all other subjects. Let's say, for example, a person is studying architecture, and he's picturing in his mind a certain building, a famous architectural wonder. His mind surrounds the idea, and the idea surrounds or envelops his mind. However, what is in his mind is only the concept of the building and not the building itself. There's a mental image of the building, not the building itself. So if a person, for example, is thinking about the Colosseum in Rome, or he's thinking about the Opera House in Australia, in his mind, he has only the image of those structures, not the structure itself. So what he's merging with is a picture, not a building, not a structure. With Torah, the godliness in the Torah, God's presence in the Torah, God's presence in the teaching, in the concept, in the thought that he is studying in the Torah, is God himself. God is available in Torah. As we were saying before, the matzah is not just a cracker. It is the presence of godliness in the physical world. It's an object of godliness. And the concepts of Torah, the words of Torah, are also godliness contained in a concept. So when the person understands the Torah, he's not merely understanding a concept given by God, he's understanding God himself godliness itself. And when he understands godliness himself, that's when this double merging takes place, where his mind is immersed in the idea, and the idea is immersed, contained in his mind. His mind surrounds the idea surrounds his mind, and they are united from all directions. That's why the study of Torah is unique among mitzvahs. It stands out because, unlike other mitzvahs, where the mitzvah surrounds the person, envelops the person, in the Torah, the connectedness is from all directions. The person surrounds the godliness, and the godliness surrounds the person. And that's why the study of Torah is compared to eating. A person is nourished and protected and is healthy in two ways, two basic human needs, and that is food and clothing. The difference between food and clothing is that food nourishes and nurtures from within. No food will do you any good if you don't ingest it. Sitting on a plate, it doesn't do you any good. The only time food does you any good is when you ingest, digest, and merge with that food to where it becomes your flesh and blood. The study of Torah nourishes the soul internally, like food, because the godliness in the Torah is absorbed internally when you study it and understand it, because understanding means surrounding, grasping, and enveloping the idea. Whereas other mitzvahs, when you put on tefillin, you give charity, you observe a holiday, here the godliness of the mitzvah transcends the person, surrounds the person, envelops the person, but the person cannot envelop the mitzvah. Perfect example, of course, would be the mitzvah of sukkah. The mitzvah is to be in the sukkah, to be eating in the sukkah. Now the sukkah surrounds you. You cannot surround or encompass the sukkah. So all mitzvahs have this quality called garment. They are the clothing. You are clothed in godliness when you do a mitzvah. But you cannot, in turn, clothe the clothing. You can't be enveloping the mitzvah. So the godliness is coming from one direction. The godliness of the mitzvah surrounds the soul of the person. But when you're studying Torah, there's a mitzvah that you're doing that surrounds you, but then there's the understanding where you surround it. So the Torah is called food, and mitzvahs are called garments. So anywhere in Torah where it says, like for example, Adam and Eve were without clothing and they were not ashamed, it means they were without mitzvahs. When they ate from the tree of knowledge, they were ashamed of the fact that they were without garments, without mitzvahs. To be without food, to be hungry, means to be without the study of Torah, because Torah to the soul is like food to the body. So when a person does a mitzvah, he is creating for himself, for his soul, garments that have all the benefits of a garment, that what the garments do for the body, the mitzvah does for the soul. And when a person studies Torah, he is giving his soul internal nourishment, what food does for the body, the study of Torah does for the soul. However, the study of Torah is both a mitzvah and a study. So in studying, you're fulfilling a mitzvah, and that becomes a garment for the soul. And in understanding what you're studying, that becomes the food for the soul and nourishes from within. If a person studies Torah but doesn't understand, it is a mitzvah to speak the words of Torah, to make an attempt to understand the Torah, but then it functions only as a garment, not as food. When he studies it and understands it, then it's both a food and a garment. What about a person who studies Torah, understands Torah, but does not believe that there's a mitzvah connected here, doesn't believe that God asked us to study Torah, or doesn't believe in God at all? If a person studies Torah and understands it, but doesn't believe in it, and doesn't believe in God, what is it then? You would think that the study of Torah without belief would be like food without a garment. Because when you believe in the Torah but don't understand it, then it's a garment, but it's not food. It's not an internal nourishment. If you do understand the Torah, but you don't see it as a mitzvah, then it should be food, nourishment, internally, but not a garment because you don't see it as a mitzvah. But the truth is that if you don't see it as a mitzvah, then even the nourishment of the understanding and the knowledge doesn't benefit the soul at all. In fact, it can actually corrupt the soul. And that is the meaning of the statement in the Talmud that a person merits and the study of Torah becomes life-giving medicine. If the person doesn't merit, then the study of Torah can become a poison that is deadly. How can the study of Torah be deadly? And what does it mean to merit or not merit? According to what we're saying, if a person studies Torah because it is a mitzvah, then the knowledge that he gains is life-giving. In fact, it's even a medicine. If the person was not spiritually healthy, he will become healed. He will become healthy. But if a person studies Torah without realizing or recognizing that it is a mitzvah, as, for example, where the Torah says that the temple, the Talmud says that the temple was destroyed because people studied Torah without making the blessing beforehand, thanking God for giving us the Torah. In other words, we studied Torah, but we separated the Torah from its giver. We separated the Torah from God. Then when you do that, then you're not meriting, then you don't have the merit, and therefore the study of the Torah becomes not life-giving, but the opposite. It becomes a poison. The knowledge of Torah is then used in a destructive way. It's used for justifying sin. It's used to justify shortcuts and loopholes and all sorts of things that are ungodly. And the arrogance that comes from the knowledge of Torah without the belief in Torah is destructive to the godly soul. And so it becomes literally a dangerous poison. So the garments of the soul, to get back to the original theme, the garments of the soul, the thought, the speech, and the deed, are what enable the love and fear of the godly soul to become immersed in the godliness present in Torah, to connect to God as he makes himself available in Torah, which is why Torah is compared to water. God becomes available even in physical deeds, even in physical letters written on parchment. God is available there, so that when the soul connects to those mitzvahs or to those words, the soul is connecting to the presence of God in the mitzvah and in the words. But how does a soul connect to Torah? Only through garments. Only by doing, by speaking, and by thinking that which God thinks, that which God says, and that which God wants done. So the garments, it turns out, are more essential in a relationship than the feelings that they express. And that's why, if we are conscious of the relationship aspect of mitzvahs, then many things which were difficult to understand suddenly begin to make sense. When we forget the relational part of the mitzvah, when we think of Torah simply as a personal growth kind of project or discipline, then many of the teachings of the Torah just don't seem to apply or don't seem to be relevant. We become very puzzled by many of the teachings because they don't seem to contribute to personal growth. But they're not meant to. They're meant to contribute to the growth of a relationship, and that is governed by a whole different set of rules. So bearing in mind that it's a relationship that we're pursuing, the Torah feels more appropriate to the relationship, seems to be more relevant, and the things that were puzzling us start to make sense, because in a relationship, these things really work. So the garments of the soul can be more important than the soul only in view of the relationship. And the same is true even of tshuva. Tshuva can be a personal experience. A person wants to clear his own conscience, wants to get things off his chest, wants to feel free and innocent again, and so he does tshuva. But that's not the way a relationship works. So if a husband says, I want to be a better husband, if a wife says, I want to be a better wife, I'm ashamed of myself, I haven't been the mensch I thought I was, I'm disappointed in myself, this is all very personal. The person is thinking about himself, how he ought to behave, how he is behaving, how he would like to behave, and the decision to behave better is simply a self-improvement project. Tshuva in a relationship is a different kind of tshuva. Here we're not thinking, how can I be the best I can be? How can I be the most I can be? Here we're thinking, is my spouse, is my husband, my wife, getting what he or she deserves? Am I doing right by them? Are they being shortchanged? Are they being mistreated? Are they being treated unjustly? This is not a self-improvement project. This is focused on a relationship. This is stepping out of myself into the reality of someone else's needs, someone else's importance, someone else's significance. And that, by its very nature, is the definition of goodness. When the other happens to be God, when we're thinking about whether we've done right by God, whether we've done justly by God, and we get focused on what God needs, what God wants, what God's plans are, His reality, His intentions in creation, and so on, then this ability to put His needs before our own is not only goodness, it's godliness. So we have a very workable definition, a very clear definition. To be good means to step out of ourselves into a reality other than our own. If that other reality is a human being, then what we're doing is goodness. If the other is God, then what we're doing is godly. Now, the godly soul, as we mentioned earlier, is not here for self-improvement. It doesn't need improvement. It can't become any more good, and it can't become any more godly for itself. But to fulfill God's needs, to fulfill God's purpose, to connect to God in the way that God wants to be joined and connected to, for this, the Torah, the commandments, offer the avenue, the opportunity to make that connection. And the only way that the soul can make that connection is by using its garments. No matter how much the soul loves God, it does not connect to God the way God wants to be connected to. It doesn't serve God's purpose or God's need. It is the motivation for serving, but it is not the service itself. And the same is true with fear of God. No matter how much the soul fears God, if it can't do a mitzvah, if it can't say the words God wants to hear, then it's not serving. It's not available to God. So without the garments, there is no connection. There's no merging of two into one, of one plus one becoming one. When the soul does the mitzvah, it has to put aside not unholy distractions, but holy distractions. In other words, for the godly soul to do a mitzvah is a different challenge than the human soul doing the mitzvah. The human soul resists doing the mitzvah because it doesn't want to be bothered, because it would rather do something more beneficial to itself. What's in it for me? The human soul asks. And so to do the mitzvah, the human soul has to forego some of its ego, centeredness, some of its selfishness, and be altruistic. The godly soul needs to do the mitzvah by putting aside its godly feelings. When the godly soul does the mitzvah, it has to forget for a moment how much it loves God, how much it fears God, how much it understands God, has to put all of that aside and focus on the simple dimensions, instructions, how the mitzvah is performed, which way does God want it done, how much matzah do you eat in order to fulfill the mitzvah, where exactly do you put the tefillin on your head and on your arm, when do you blow shofar, how many times, what sounds do you make. How does God want this done? This is called stepping out of your own reality into someone else's reality. And then when people say, but I don't understand, what in the world makes this sound meaningful? What makes this amount of matzah meaningful? I don't appreciate these details. Now we realize that in a relationship, that argument, that question, is totally irrelevant. Of course you don't appreciate the importance of this detail. It is not a detail in your reality. It is a detail in someone else's reality. It is significant in their world, not in your world. And the whole point of a relationship is that you can step out of what is important, significant, meaningful, and appealing in your reality and actually engage in what is appealing and significant and important and meaningful in someone else's reality. When that someone else is God, it's even less surprising that what is meaningful to God would not be meaningful to us. What is reasonable to God would not be reasonable to us, because our reality is not the same as God's reality. And that's why the Torah says, my thoughts are not your thoughts, my ways are not your ways, but through the garments, we can actually connect and become one.